This is the Michael Lerner Conference with Common Will on January 18, 2006, beginning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time.
The U.S. EPA actually has a mandate under FQPA, which is the Food Quality Protection Act, to use a cumulative risk assessment approach for chemicals that share what is termed a common mechanism. From an environmental perspective, a concern with this is that thyroid disruptors, and I use that term very broadly to mean a chemical which will disrupt the function of the gland, which would include what Tom talked about in terms of hormone synthesis, transport of the hormones to the cells, use of that hormone in the cell, and even, and most people don't think very much about this, but the liver. The liver actually plays a large role in catabolism, meaning metabolism or destruction of the hormones. So anything that disrupts any of those processes is what I call a thyroid disruptor. And there are a number of targets, well-known environmental targets for these. So you can hit, as I said, uptake in the gland, you can hit synthesis in the gland, you can disrupt the transport. As Tom says, there's some direct effects on the receptor that we know about, and we know that a lot of environmental chemicals will upregulate the process of catabolism. Now, these processes all lead to disruptions in the circulating levels of hormones, with one exception, and that's the effects on that are direct on the receptor that Tom was talking about. So our goal has been, and the project that we've had ongoing for quite a while now, is to better understand the risk of these simultaneous exposures to chemicals and how they disrupt circulating levels of hormones, with the ultimate goal of protecting against adverse effects on neural development. So Elise actually said that I should mention a recent study that we published, and I wonder if I could spend about a minute describing this and then tell you a little bit about what happened,
right. What
we found. We used a short-term rodent model to look at the effects of a large mixture of PHAHs. Those are polyhalogenated aromatic hydrocarbons. Those include chemicals like dioxins and dibenzofurans and PCBs. These are very commonly found in pretty much any media, environmental media you want to look at, including humans. We used a short-term rodent model for this because we've shown that in the past to be a good and sensitive marker for the kinds of mechanisms that these compounds will disrupt. We measured thyroid circulating levels of hormones in these animals. We did extensive characterization of the dose response curves for 18 PHAHs. And that's kind of important because in the kind of statistical modeling that's used to analyze this data, the better the dose response function, the better you are able to actually analyze the data. We then actually tested a mixture of these 18 chemicals, and the composition of this mixture was based on human exposures. And by that I mean there was very small amounts of dioxin in this mixture, and there were large concentrations of some of the PCBs like PCB-153. So we actually went to sources like human breast milk samples, human fat tissue samples, samples of beef and fish, to find out what the mixture concentration was, to try and create a really truly environmentally relevant mixture. The other thing that we did was we actually went down into the low dose range. We actually tested doses given to the rat which are roughly equivalent to that of human background exposures. So what did we find? We found that additivity theory actually predicts effects at the low end of the mixture dose. So if you're using dilutions of that mixture, which represents something in the neighborhood of where humans are getting exposed, that additivity theory, that the statistics behind that, will actually predict those effects. We also found a small amount of synergy at the high end. So if you're talking about doses which are orders of magnitude higher than what humans would get exposed to, then additivity theory actually underpredicts risk there, but not by very much. We're within about a twofold range of predicting, which is pretty good. So I also wanted to outline a little bit of some of the uncertainties in this work to make sure that people don't make too much of this. We only tested one of the sort of tox pathways. So when I talked earlier about the different target sites that can be disrupted, the only one that these chemicals really aims at primarily is liver upregulating liver catabolism. Now, Tom and some others have some evidence that there may be a small amount of direct effects at the receptor covering two pathways. There was also only short-term dosing. We used rats. Everybody, I think, on the phone is pretty well aware of the uncertainties that happen when you try and take rat data and extrapolate it to humans. And then one of the other things that's really important is one of the pathways that we looked at, and that's it's the molecular target for these chemicals that cause the upregulation of enzymes in the liver, which then cause a decrease in the circulating hormone levels, is called the CAR-PXR pathway. And without getting too in-depth on it, there is a little bit of in vitro evidence which suggests that some environmental chemicals which act as agonists at that pathway actually act as antagonists at that pathway in human tissues. And that's in vitro evidence, and it's something we're trying to follow up. I just wanted to make sure people understood that the sky's not falling based on this work, but it does suggest that we need to do a lot more work in this area.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's so important that we begin to do this kind of additive and synergistic research. It's, as you stated, it's been very rare. So thank you for your work in that arena. Next is Dr. Jim Hatto. Jim?
Yes, thank you. The work that I'm going to talk about that we had done focuses on a different area in that we really weren't able to examine some of the basics that have just been discussed, namely some of the environmental antecedents of thyroid deficiency. And so what we did do was to look at a general population of women who had been pregnant, and we had had an opportunity to do some routine testing on them, and then we were able to go back 7 to 9 years later and examine their children, and also to follow the women up to see how they were doing as far as their thyroid function was concerned. What we had discovered was that the children of women who were thyroid deficient but not diagnosed as being thyroid deficient, in other words, they couldn't be treated during pregnancy, had an IQs that averaged 7 points lower than control children. We were able to do this study because we had sera from 25,000 pregnancies that had been tested in our laboratory. And we were able to do the thyroid testing, specifically the TSH, or thyroid-stimulating hormone testing, 7 years after the pregnancy, determine which of the measurements were consistent with thyroid deficiency, and then set up a case-control study in which we went out and found the women, asked for them to come with their children so that we could do the appropriate testing. So the first finding was, as I've mentioned, that the IQs averaged 7 points lower on the children whose mothers had been untreated and thyroid deficient during pregnancy. The second finding, which I think would be relevant to this call, was that when we inquired of the women what their current status was, as far as they knew, as far as thyroid was concerned, we discovered that two-thirds of the women who were thyroid deficient but not treated during pregnancy now were permanently hypothyroid. And we were able to extract the same information from our controls, and we learned that about 4% of those were now thyroid deficient, and that's consistent with reports from other long-range follow-up studies. So the presence of thyroid deficiency as measured by TSH in pregnancy turns out to be a strong marker for permanent hypothyroidism in the years that follow the pregnancy. Furthermore, we discovered that it took an average of 5 years for the diagnosis to be made clinically, and about 4 or 5 of the women had not been diagnosed until we actually helped make the diagnosis 7 or 8 years later. So this, to us, was a revelation. We actually didn't anticipate that this large a percentage of women would actually turn out to be permanently hypothyroid, and this led us to begin designing further studies to try and learn more about how to deal with this and how to avoid some of the adverse consequences that might occur if the women were not diagnosed. I think that's pretty much the summary of the relevant information.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Haddo. And finally, Dr. Gregory Brent will focus on the implications for public policy of some of the research and thyroid screening and testing that has been described.
Sure. Thanks, Elise. And it's a pleasure to be on the call today. I really come at this from a couple of points of view. One, as a basic researcher in iodine transport and thyroid hormone action, but also in my role as secretary of the American Thyroid Association, have been involved in the last several years of trying to translate some of this information you've heard about into public policy and trying to impact things. Just to pick up on what Jim's talked about, his study has had just a huge impact on the area, not only to look at identifying women who are hypothyroid and the impact on their intellectual development of their offspring, but just understanding that that pregnant women and their fetuses are a marker of susceptibility to reduced thyroid function and agents that might do that, some of which you heard about before. So I've had a lot of interest in looking at some examples of that would be iodine nutrition, which in some areas of the U.S. may not be adequate, and this would be a target for intervention in terms of iodine supplementation during pregnancy. Some very recent information that's showing that women with this mild sort of hypothyroidism that Dr. Haddo talked about may also be at a major risk for preterm delivery. And, of course, there's lots of impact of preterm delivery in terms of intellectual development and neurologic development. We're at sort of the public policy level is really trying to get all the people that are involved in identification and study of these diseases as well as treatment together. And certainly from the medical point of view, it's trying to especially enlist the cooperation of OBGYNs who see many of these pregnant women, as well as pediatricians, and then also to expand to the sort of information you've heard about from people that are doing the basic research, toxicologists, epidemiologists, and actually, in just to call your attention to some of the material that's in the resource section on this, is that there's been efforts working with National Institutes of Environmental Health, with the CDC, to try to identify what the issues are, and there's proceedings from some of these conferences that are posted for you, as well as efforts we have upcoming, a conference March 24th, where we'll bring these people together to expand not only looking at environmental impacts on thyroid hormone action, as you've heard about, in synthesis, but even looking at some of the increased incidence of thyroid diseases, such as thyroid cancer seems to be on the increase, autoimmune thyroid disease, and what potential environmental triggers there could be for that. So the goal in this area is to both identify the diseases, what the connections are, as well as to look at some ways to intervene. And the key, really, to those interventions are cooperating across disciplines and across agencies. And you can see some examples of that are stored in the resource section. So I look forward to the questions and discussion.
Great. Thank you so much to all four of you for being so clear and succinct. Probably one of the best modeling of that we've had on these calls. So thank you very much. And I'm sure you've also provoked a number of questions in people's minds. So I think we'll now open it up to question and answer. We have about a half hour or so. And Eleni?
Yes, I can go through that. So what we'll do first is the operator will place everyone in talk and listen mode. So if you could go ahead and do that now, operator, and let me know when you've done that.
I am doing that now. And if everyone could please be aware that when their lines do go into talk listen, if you place your lines on hold, you will pipe music into the call. Otherwise, here we go.
Great. And so now we'd like to ask everyone on the line, if you don't plan on asking a question at the moment, to keep the ambient noise down, please go ahead to either mute and unmute your line. Please hit star 6. Go ahead and do that now.
Okay.
Elise?
Thank you very much. So questions, please. And please state your name and affiliation. Thank you.
This is Phil Lee, and I'd like to ask Brent a question about the policy. Brent, to what extent have you involved organizations like Kaiser Permanente or other organizations with large numbers of pregnant women where you might affect studies of those populations on a fairly systematic basis?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm sure Dr. Haddo will have, who's really done the epidemiology, those sort of large studies on pregnancy, and I'll make a quick comment and then let him comment on the question, too. I think that you know, what you're asking is how do we translate some of the information, I think, to the large groups, both to affect change and how they practice clinically as well as to use the information from those large groups. And the, I guess the answer from our point of view is that we're, you know, working on a number of levels, especially to impact OBGYN behavior, working with their national organizations. But part of the problem is knowing exactly what to instruct them. We know that there's women who are hypothyroid and pregnant who are not being identified, and whether the best way is to screen those women and how to identify them is certainly the problem. I'm going to turn it to Dr. Haddow because I know that he'll have some comments on that question.
I think the policy is still in the shaping stage for how to deal with this situation of thyroid deficiency in pregnancy, all the way from trying to make sure that the laboratory performance is correct, because there are some variations in the way that the tests are measured in the TSH levels during pregnancy from non-pregnancy. But beyond that, there's a question, and I think certainly a correct question been raised, that we don't know yet if we can avoid the IQ problems by identification and treatment of the women during pregnancy. We can correct the problem in the mother, but whether or not the brain problem has already occurred is not yet clear. So that's a matter that I think several groups have been trying to figure out a way to study. When it comes to the long-term consequences for the mother, I think that those are less an issue. In other words, we know that we've documented that women with thyroid deficiency, most of them will go on to become truly hypothyroid, and this is not just from our study, but from a study in England as well. So I don't think that that's such a problem, although I do feel, from having looked at the literature recently, that we could gain by having more specific information about where the cutoff is for risk of going into the state of permanent hypothyroidism. How thyroid deficient do you need to be in order to be at high risk? These are more questions of refinement than they are the primary issue of the fact that there is this risk, at least in a select group of women who are thyroid deficient during pregnancy. So in any case, the one area that you might be interested in is that we surveyed all major practices in the state of Maine late in 2004, and it's just coming out in a publication in the next couple of months, to see what proportion of physicians were screening routinely. And it turned out that about two-thirds were screening either routinely or close enough to routinely that it could be considered in that category. As a word of caution, that is probably unusual, in that the original studies that I quoted were done in Maine, and the physicians in Maine were sensitized to this, and I think that many of them simply picked up on the fact that even in their own state we had this finding that occurred from our study. So the short answer is that we're still, I think, in a state of flux about establishing a permanent policy, and as with any of these matters in medicine, it really does take time and a lot of working through, and I think Gregory and the ATA are pursuing a steady course, trying to help everyone understand what direction might make sense. There are other groups as well involved. There are some variations in the way they view policy making right now. So I think we'll see a clearer story emerge over the next 2 or 3 years.
Great, thank you. And I just want to remind participants that Dr. Phil Lee is chair of the collaboratives, and that really appreciate that excellent question and the very helpful responses. Other questions, please.
My name's Don. I have a question for Dr. Zeller.
Can you say your full name and affiliation?
My name's Donna Barnett, and I'm an individual that was interested in the conference call because I had thyroid cancer. I was diagnosed in 1984 when I was 24, and there's been no history of cancer in my family. and I'm dependent on Synthroid now, and there's been talk that Synthroid's had some problems, but it's the only thing I've known. And I was wondering if you could speak to the effectiveness of Synthroid or other hormone replacements and what hormone disruptors I may be aware of or should be aware of.
Thank you, Donna.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me sort of defer to
Dr. Zeller.
Greg, yeah, this is Dr. Zeller. Greg Brent probably has a much better sense, since he is a clinician that prescribes thyroid hormone. He can give you a sense of you know, the different activities of preparation. So I hope that's right, Greg.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Maybe I'll make a comment and maybe turn it back to you, Tom. But I mean, I guess the question is, well, there's a couple there. When you take the synthetic thyroid hormone, it is chemically identical to what your thyroid makes in terms of the composition of T4, but it would be equally affected if there are the kind of disruptors that Dr. Zeller and Dr. Crofton talked about relative to the thyroid hormone action. So that would be independent of the preparation you're taking. There is some interest in the thyroid hormone field in terms of the mode of replacement, whether you only use levothyroxine, so-called T4, or add additionally the activated form T3. And it may be that some of these environmental toxicants that we're talking about, in fact, Dr. Crofton mentioned this, that may be acting in the liver that would affect thyroid hormone metabolism. And so if one is especially exposed to those or sensitive to them, it may be that you'd have a different mode of replacement. But, you know, like some of the other things we're talking about, this is an area where, based on animal models, it may be the reality. It's tough in an individual patient to do the kind of test to understand how thyroid hormone is acting in these tissues, but there's a lot of interest to do that. And the other issue that you mentioned in terms of thyroid cancer, and there is, the best model is in Chernobyl, but clearly radiation exposure has increased thyroid cancer. The incidence of thyroid cancer in women in the U.S. is going up, and we're, you know, actively trying to look at areas. There's investigators at National Cancer Institute trying to identify what those factors are that are promoting it. So there's kind of two parts to the question, and that's what I'd say.
The only thing I might add to that is that there are a number of studies that are trying to associate body burdens of a variety of factors like polychlorinated diphenyls and polybrominated diphenyl ethers with thyroid function. And while, excuse me, some of these studies have seen an association, that is, the higher the level of PCB body burden, for example, the lower your thyroid hormone levels would be. Still, those thyroid hormone levels are within the normal range for the population. So at this point, it's not really clear to what extent environmental chemicals are impacting human thyroid function. That's a difficult issue, and so I'm for one not convinced that there isn't an association, because I don't think the kinds of studies that need to be done have been done, but those are the kinds of chemicals that you would worry about.
By the way, I want to mention.
Is this Donna again?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's
okay,
Donna.
Just to make it succinct, because we do have a lot of other callers I know want to ask questions.
I just want to mention that in the early 80s, I lived with my boyfriend who I slept with every night, who was working on the nuclear power plant in Orange County. And I don't know if he brought anything home. I don't know if other people in that area, there's a higher incidence of cancer.
That's a good point.
Yes, I have a question Dr. Brent.
Yes, who's this?
My name is Stern Glass. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Pittsburgh Department of Radiology. And I have been investigating the role of very low levels of radioactivity from nuclear plants and from dental radiography, and I wondered whether or not Dr. Brent might want to comment on the article by Hu Joel and others in the April 28th JMA on antepartum dental radiography and infant low birth weight, which clearly indicates very small doses, such as we get from x-rays, dental x-rays, to the thyroid, and from environmental small concentrations of releases from nuclear plants that could be significant. significant synergistic factor in the rise of hyperthyroidism and cancer.
I'm not familiar with the article, although I certainly would echo that there's a lot of interest in what you're describing. There was a recent article in the Scientist on just tracking from the nuclear fallout in previous nuclear testing and trying to track effects on thyroid function. So that this is significant. I know
When
I go to the dentist and I get X-rays, I'm sure that my thyroid is covered. So, but maybe Dr. Haddow or the other panelists have more knowledge on this. But wanna
other comments?
I don't have specific knowledge about that area. The
this is Dr. Haddow, right?
I'm sorry. Yes, Dr.
Okay.
Haddow. one thing, though, I would say we should be a bit cautious about is that making the connection between dental radiography, thyroid, and low birth weight, I think is something that we have to be very careful about, because although I haven't looked at the stories directly of dental X-ray, the association between thyroid deficiency and low birth weight is weak, and it's there, but it's not a strong association. And I think we'd have to really look into it more closely before making any definitive statements as far as the X-ray factor is concerned.
This is Sandy Roth of Health and Habitat. I wonder if there's any information on the incidence of hypothyroidism and fluoride in the drinking water.
Thank you. Any comments on that?
This is Kevin Crofton, not that I know of.
Others?
All right. Yeah, I was going to defer to Dr. Crofton, but I was involved with the perchlorate committee on National Academy of Science, and I think we looked at every aspect of water related to thyroid function, and as far as I know, this did not come up.
Thank you. Other questions?
I have a question and a comment.
Yes?
My name is Roy Ozan, and I'm a practicing physician, and I've been working with primarily nutrition for the last 25 years, and I wonder a little bit about the forest and the trees here, because we see as time's going on, as we get increased toxicity, decreased nutrition, whatever it is, both diabetes, adrenals, thyroid, reproductive hormone, we can talk about every single system of our body. And what I see in patients that really take on a very serious approach to nutrition is they have fewer of all of these problems, all of their problems get less severe, and their children are markedly better when we work on their health. And so we need all this specific documenting what chemicals do what, but not to lose track in the meanwhile that one of the best overall protections is an extremely good diet, which is not easy to do these days. And then I'm wondering, the best nutritional group I found is the Weston Price Foundation. They're doing an excellent job of promoting high-quality foods and especially targeting mothers and preconception nutrition. If we could get, there are quite a large number of people now very motivated in that foundation, at the grassroots organization. There might be a large enough group to get some really good information about how do these different factors change when there is a very high level of nutrition. They might be a wonderful group to get some more information that might be very practical, useful in terms of how do we cope with this increasing burden of toxicity.
This is a really important question, and we've given some thought in the collaborative in terms of the overlap between toxic chemicals and nutrition. Are there any comments from the panelists on the nutrition question?
Yeah, this is Kevin Crofton. One of the things that has worried me, and we are actually beginning a very small research program on, is the potential interface between what I call sort of marginal iodine deficiency. So these are people who would not normally be tagged by a physician for having an iodine deficiency, but maybe sort of on the cusp, and the interface between that and environmental chemicals that might impact the thyroid hormone system.
I might add that it is a good idea to watch the iodine, natural iodine, because it is protective against the uptake of small amounts of radioactive iodine. And that could be a big factor in the diet, as well as antioxidants that are involved in the protection of the body against the free radical damage, which is the dominant damage from low-level ionizing radiation.
Really important issue. Any other comments on nutrition? Thank you.
Last comment on the nutrition. Doing iodine challenge tests where you measure excretion before you give iodine, give 50 micrograms or whatever that was level of iodine, and then retest. I don't find a normal person in my practice.
Interesting.
In terms of iodine sufficiency.
Hmm.
And I think that's true, and just so it's not just iodine that we're deficient in. So, but thank you for considering the situation.
Thank you for that comment. Other questions?
This is Lynn Cannon from the Learning Disabilities Association, and I have a question for Dr. Haddow. I wanted to know whether in your group of untreated patients, whether you studied any subsequent pregnancies of those patients and, in fact, looked at the younger siblings, the IQ of the younger siblings of the children that you identified with lower IQ. I wanted to know if there was a further lowering, whether there was no lowering, or whether it was essentially the same as the first child that you were studying.
This is Jim Haddow answering. We did not look at subsequent children. We weren't smart enough in our study design to include that. And, you know, I mean, this is one of the things that we regret. We'd love to have had that information, but we had a certain resource to work with, and we had to focus on the primary children, the index children.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
More opportunities for further research.
Yeah.
Yep.
Other questions, please?
Yes, this is Tom Muir, retired Environment Canada. Just to Kevin Crofton, do you have any plans on adding any more chemicals into the mix, like bromated flame retardants or phthalates or bisphenol A?
So, this is Kevin. That's actually a great question, and the answer is yes. Maybe not brominated flame retardants because we think they act quite similarly to the PCBs, but definitely to add things like fungicides, which act to block synthesis of the hormones, perchlorate, which will block iodine uptake, and then maybe even add a nutritional component, as I said, by actually doing this in marginally iodine-deficient animals. That's an excellent question.
And I was asking about the brominated flame retardants just to get the dose up to better reflect the real-world exposures, as you pointed out. Not just the mechanism, but when you add something else.
Oh, I see.
Making it worse.
I haven't thought of it that way. That's a very interesting comment. Because you could, depending upon the population you're looking at, you could actually almost double the entire PHAH load.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good. Other questions, please?
I might make one comment. This is Phyllis Mullinex.
Yes.
It was mentioned earlier, a question about fluoride. There are some new studies out that is coming from countries that have fluoride poisoning problems in the drinking water, usually higher than what we have here. But nonetheless, there's several research papers that have looked at the iodine levels in conjunction with fluoride levels, and found that there was an additive and synergistic effect between fluoride and iodine levels. And these papers have shown where they're looking not only at the TSH levels, but they're also looking at fluoride receptor effects and effects on other enzymes and synthesis and release. I just wondered if there was any comment, if you've been following any of that new research.
Actually, this is Kevin, if I could take a first stab at that. First thing is, hi, Phyllis. The second is, could you send me those references? Because I haven't been following that at all.
Well,
and if there really is an interaction between fluoride and iodine, then I'd be very interested.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the professors that's been doing that type of research, there's a lot of it going on in China in particular, will be in this country and will be visiting with me. But they have been working on animal models that combine fluoride levels with the iodine level, and they're definitely showing further increases with lowering of IQ in children. They've done both animal models and human studies. So I do have a relatively complete listing of those thyroid studies, and like I said, they're mainly studies that have been done either in the late 1990s to just recently, 2005 studies.
Great.
So I can provide you references.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Ted Shetler with the Science and Environmental Health Network. I'm wondering, Dr. Brent, what your advice to women is now. I think we're seeing is that there are some women who know that they're thyroid deficient or have subclinical hypothyroidism, but their medical care providers are not aware of some of these issues. And because of the importance of thyroid hormone levels early in pregnancy, how would you advise a woman who is contemplating pregnancy, who is subclinically hypothyroid, in terms of how to approach this if she's not getting a proactive response from her physician?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm sure Dr. Haddow will have some comments also. But as Dr. Haddow said, that although we're not at a stage yet to say that the intervention, meaning normalizing thyroid hormone levels in those women, definitely prevents the adverse outcomes, the reduced IQ and the offspring and preterm delivery, we all think that that's highly likely, at least based on the studies so far. And so, there is some controversy over those women who have been identified with mild thyroid insufficiency, whether they should be replaced. But, it's certainly our recommendation, which is in the material, in the reference material from the American Thyroid Association and CDC conferences, is those women should be normalized. And in fact, because of the increased requirements during pregnancy, where it's really a stress on the thyroid gland, the target TSH level, which reflects the amount of replacement, should be towards the low normal range. Dr. Haddow alluded to some differences in pregnancy, and in fact, the normal TSH in the first trimester of pregnancy is significantly lower than in the normal population or non-pregnant population. So the bottom line is, our recommendation for those women with those qualifications is that they should be replaced to actually a low normal TSH, meaning slightly elevated thyroid hormone doses, because in fact, that first trimester probably is the most important. And if you wait until that time, you may be missing a window of opportunity in terms of optimizing maternal thyroid status for the fetus. So I'd welcome also Dr. Haddow's input on the question.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is Jim Haddow. I think that we all feel that trying to convince the clinicians involved with prenatal care to try to identify any thyroid problems as early as possible in pregnancy is extremely important. And, of course, this is true for the women who are known to be hypothyroid as well. They need to be attended to promptly. One bit of supplementary information that might be of some interest is that we had an opportunity to look at blood samples that had been collected from women in both the first and second trimesters of pregnancy. In other words, the same woman would have a sample drawn at 8 weeks gestation and then at, say, 16 weeks. And this was for another study that was being done, and then we turned around afterwards and realized that we should have a look at some of the thyroid measurements as well. And we discovered that in the first trimester, a number of the women had, a small number, but predictable, had values in the upper range, in the range that would be considered between just thyroid deficient and, frankly, hypothyroid. And the same women in the second trimester had values that were not elevated. In other words, without anything being done on our part or anything being said or even known, the medical care appeared to have been focused enough on this that the values had come down to or close to the normal range. So there is activity going on at the primary care level that would say to us that the message is getting through. And I thought this was quite encouraging, because we did see earlier on that this was not the case when we used this same kind of laboratory evidence to see what was going on.
I'd like to add a comment here. This is Roy Ozan again. And just my experience and that of other physicians who are nutritionally minded, the low thyroid mother or submarginal low thyroid, they do wonderfully well mostly with nutritional replacement. And that means I'm really talking about food. And the type of diet that does that is well described, and since it doesn't hurt anyone and it presents problems in all other organ systems and delivers beautiful children, that I think our primary care physicians in this country really need to get more behind in good nutrition. And just a resource was the July issue of Wise Traditions from the Weston A. Price Foundation. It's a fantastic journal, totally devoted to preconception and pregnancy nutrition and postnatal. It's wonderful.
Thank you for that comment.
This is Marcia Mark.
Go ahead, Marcia. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, I had a question. It's really a policy question, whether there's enough data now to recommend testing for all females for thyroid disease. And I wanted to use an example. When my daughter was 10 years old, she had Hashimoto's thyroid disease, at age 10, that is. And I would think it was only after, really, I was very persistent, because I have some medical background, that I got the doctor to test her. So, I mean, there must be a lot of children and other females who have, this type of problem. And, you know, we have so many radionuclides from the 103 nuclear reactors and all the waste, nuclear waste, and the endocrine-disrupting chemicals. Wouldn't it be cost-effective to catch all of this hypothyroidism early rather than have all these other problems?
That's an important question. Should we, are we at a point where we can now say, it should be required of all women of childbearing years or even prior to that?
I'm thinking
comments?
Even children, female children.
Yeah, thank you. Comments on that?
Christina Zern from
the... No, comments from the panelists, I'm sorry,
okay.
In response to Marcia's question.
This is Greg Brett. I'll make a quick comment. I mean, this is certainly, a major focus of concern. And certainly anyone with any clinical suspicion, so-called case finding based on family history or symptoms, should be tested. When you start to look at screening and, questions of cost effectiveness, you ask questions, which test should you use, just the TSH or also, the free T4 level of thyroxine or antibodies, because the antibodies would also pick up women who have postpartum thyroiditis, for example. And then the issue of the timing, which Dr. Haddow alluded to, pre-pregnancy would be optimal. It's hard to find, capture all the women that way. The first trimester may be too late, but also may be more predictive of downstream events. So, we're all very interested in certainly identifying the women, trying to find the best tests and the way to do it. I think the answer right now from an epidemiology point of view and health services is that we don't have the data yet to promote screening across the board for those kind of questions that I've given, but we certainly do strongly encourage anyone with any suspicion or risk factors for thyroid disease, which could include other autoimmune diseases, type 1 diabetes, et cetera, to be tested. So we're trying to push for the testing and then gather more data to better focus the kind of screening we do.
Wouldn't this
Thank you. We could probably have time for just one more question.
This is Vinny Gehry. Can I get my
Go ahead.
All right. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota. One of the questions that I have is, in Minnesota, we screen for TSH function in the newborn period. And there are a lot of kids that have transient neonatal hypothyroidism. And I'm wondering, did we go back to those mothers?
I'll let Dr. Haddow comment too. It's Greg Brandt. I mean, definitely, those, you know, some of those moms will be on antithyroid drugs so that they'll have the infants will get some of that and have a transient elevation in TSH. But I, you know, anecdotally have seen a number of cases where the moms are not tested and in fact do have, you know, some transient hypothyroidism. Sometimes there's blocking antibodies or a postpartum thyroiditis. So I do think that, you know, that should heighten suspicion. But Dr. Haddow, I know, deals with this directly if he's still on.
Yes.
There you are. Okay.
This is Jim Haddow. And I can give some direct data from the same study I was talking about earlier. We went to the newborn screening records at the regional laboratory in Boston to see if we could document any information about thyroid deficiency in the newborn, transient or otherwise, among the study subjects of the mothers who were thyroid deficient. And though we did not find any evidence in our study. Now, that was given, that was limited in numbers, of course. We had 62 study subjects.
Yeah, we've got years worth of data on these kids, you know.
We're going to have to wrap up now. I'm really sorry to have to cut off comments, and I know there were more questions, but I just want to take a moment before I turn the call over to Eleni for final wrap-up to just thank all of our presenters. It was excellent, and the questions, I think, were very informative and useful. So, again, thank you to everyone who joined us today, and particularly to our presenters. Eleni, do you want to mention the last call?
Yes,
the
thank
next
you.
Call,
yes, I just want to mention that we have scheduled the February National Partnership call. It will be on February 28th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and the subject will be nanotechnology and environmental public health. And also note that we will be sending out our monthly e-newsletter this afternoon, so if you keep an eye out for that, we'll have some information about the call as well. I thank everyone, and we look forward to seeing you next month on the call. Take care, everyone. Okay. Bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Thank you.